content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Anna Dean Silver from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Out in the Garden. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from a special edition of Real Simple, The Power of Plants, Calming Benefits, Houseplants and Healing Gardens that Thrive. And each chapter and article is by a different person, so I will let you know when we do read that, who it's by. And this time we start with a life force. In the face of post-traumatic stress, a novice gardener discovered that nurturing living things helped her spirits bloom again. And this is by Deborah Kopakin. The thing about post-traumatic stress disorder is you never know when it will strike. I've learned this over the course of managing it for decades. The day I took my first post-vaccine stroll without a mask in April 2021, I started feeling that familiar neck prickle. Excuse me. I was passing an outdoor garden supply store at the time, so I hid behind a potted tree, took some deep breaths, breaths among the lilacs, and on an impulse I can only describe as involuntary, purchased 12 seedlings, cherry tomatoes, mint, lettuce, rosemary, parsley, strawberries, sage, and bell peppers. Had I ever grown a garden before? No, I had not. But my subconscious had spoken, and if I've learned anything while managing my PTSD, it's to tune in to that voice. Plus watering and talking to my indoor plants during the COVID lockdown had become the one chore I looked forward to. In fact, I'd become so adept at keeping my plants alive during COVID, not only had I not killed them, but they, unlike the rest of us, were flourishing. Back at home, I made small talk with my seedlings. How's the photosynthesis going? Got any fun hot plant summer plans? And felt my heartbeat return to normal. My chest untightened. I could breathe without feeling as if I would die from lack of oxygen. As a photojournalist, I've survived wars. As a woman, I've been through divorce, layoffs, debt, rape, assault, health crisis, and sexual harassment. All those experiences have created a hair trigger response in my body. Before I sought talk therapy, the sound of a helicopter, a parking ticket on my windshield, or footsteps behind me could release a flood of stress hormone cortisol into my bloodstream. A few years before the pandemic began, my therapist taught me a coping strategy. Whenever I'd describe a traumatic event to him, triggering an attack of PTSD, he'd immediately notice the shift in my posture and breathing and say, "Okay, let's stop for a moment to check in with your body." I'd place my feet on the ground, sit up straight, and take deep, mindful breaths, steadying my body and mentally surveying it, part by part, starting from my feet and moving up to my head. This technique, called grounding, counterbalances the cortisol, helping me release the emotions that remain stuck in my body like splinters as a result of all those negative experiences. Grounding can be achieved in multiple ways. One of them, I realized last spring, is tending a garden. After doing some basic YouTube research on raised beds and liners, after finally planting my new seedlings in the sunny spot on my roof in Brooklyn, I realized, duh, there's no access to water up there. So I bought a giant watering can, filled it in the bathtub, and made my peace with lugging it up and down the stairs several times each morning. A few weeks later, I added 3 pots of roses. I still had some extra space. Roses are beautiful, and as the fox reminds the little prince in Antoine de Saint-Exupéry's classic story, c'est le temps que tu es perdu pour ta rose qui fait ta rose si importante. This sentence is sometimes translated as, it's the time you have spent on your rose that makes your rose so important. But that's more of a transactional, dare I say, American interpretation of the verb perdre. Instead of to spend, a more accurate translation would be to lose or to waste, but without a negative spin. It's the Proustian ideal of lost time. In other words, wasted only on the act of living, breathing, and being, however productively or not. In fact, a daily mindful grounding practice need not yield any flowers at all. The value is in the work itself. A journal kept, a canvas painted, bread baked, music composed, breaths breathed, sandcastles sculpted. Trauma is a too vivid reminder of all blossoms, including us, will one day wither. Gardening in whatever medium is in choosing to live. My daily practice brought me quite literally down to earth. I deadheaded and pruned the rose bushes, harvested herbs, fruit and lettuce, pinched off aphids and dead leaves and dill blossoms, and made sure I took a little time every morning to just sit and sip my coffee amid the growth. Over the months that followed, leaf by leaf, I came back to myself, the man I loved who weathered the isolation of lockdown with me, suggested building a large pergola so that on the hottest days I could still sit in the garden. But the thing about gardens is that even the most carefully tended ones don't last forever. One morning, after watering my plants, I came downstairs and stumbled upon a new trauma. Never mind the details, suffice it to say, I wound up screaming, "Who builds a pergola for someone you're cheating on?" My partner and I had lived together for 4 years. I don't remember much after that, just the thwack of the stainless steel Hydra flask I was carrying, which I managed not to hurl at his head, smashing into the ground with such a cortisol-fueled force it sprang a leak. I fled my garden and our shared home and holed up with some girlfriends near the ocean for a while to give my partner time to pack up his stuff and myself time to process my grief through water, which is another form of grounding. "Please just water the plants while I'm gone," I told him. But the next time I saw my garden, the roses were dead, the peppers were askew, and a squirrel had shuffled off this mortal coil under what was left of my basil. The roses weren't salvageable. I yanked them up from the roots, cutting my hands on their thorns. A friend helped me with the squirrel. I gingerly edged my spade under him, and we screamed when he flipped straight up into the air like a pancake. Then, after disposing of the flattened furry corpse, I filled the watering can, lugged the heavy load back up the stairs, and sprinkled it over my wilted plants, grounding myself in both my body and the task at hand. Stem by stem, day by day, I promised myself I would prune the dead leaves, save those I could, and bring my garden back to life. And another story here is my perfectly imperfect garden. Tending to flowers doesn't always work out like you hoped, and that can be where the pleasure lies. And this is by Jane DeLurie. In midlife, newly single, I decided to transform my backyard into a perfect garden. Why I thought myself capable of such an endeavor, I do not know. I'd barely tinkered with the flower beds outside the home I'd shared with my ex-husband, and to mediocre results. I had a woeful history of houseplants. This didn't stop me as I walked outside that first April, shovel in hand. Since signing the deed to this house, I'd gone to sleep with visions of peonies and sunflowers and sweet shady nooks in my head. I believed I could learn what I needed to know to make these visions come true. I recognized my impulsive determination from my life as a fiction writer. I wanted the garden to exist, but more important, the garden seemed to want to exist as certain stories do. The backyard at the time was more yard than garden. Two ill-matched fences, one slumped forward, contained a lawn of clover that ran into a concrete parking pad. Above, power lines and cables sagged into an alley. There was a dogwood under which the previous owner had buried her cat, and flower beds of plasticized wood filled with knockout rose bushes and liriope plants. I considered cliches. First, First, I pulled out the faux wood, intending to eventually replace it with cedar. I dug up the rose bushes and the liriope and gave them to a friend in a bucket of water. Then I sat down at a patio table, skirted by concrete. I looked around and let my mind whirl. I wanted my garden to be a wild, free space, alive with primary colors and movement and surprises. Wisps that caught in the wind like feathers, coiling vines and bursting blossoms. I would grow gorgeous tomatoes, beautiful basil, and plump strawberries for my two daughters and me to feast on all summer. Somewhere, wisteria would drip Englishly, my love of 19th century British novels and their cinematic adaptations heavily influenced my sensibility. From brimming beds, hollyhocks would erupt near clouds of Queen Anne's lace. Goldfinches and monarchs would dine on the wildflowers, and I planned to grow beside the fence. 6 years later, I still want that garden. Every spring, I work in compost and yank up weeds, sprinkle seeds, dig in transplants. Then I draw a map of what I've done, adding to it all summer, until the Baltimore heat stops me from planting. Every fall, I mark up the spring map in red pen. Don't put the cucumbers there next time. Spotty mildew. Move climbing rose to fence. Needs more sun. The next year, I do it again. I have spent hundreds of dollars on dirt and seeds and plants and wooden flower boxes, clay pots, trellises, a wire corset for the paprika yarrow that flopped over, bearing its beautiful heads in its straggly stems. From April to August, I start my day by walking outside with a cup of coffee, scouting for new blooms and shoots, and I end my day clogs deep in the beds, pulling up renegade morning glory or deadheading digitalis, my legs speckled with dirt. The ideas sprout as fast as the radishes. I will try growing potatoes in a burlap sack. What about artichokes? I will plant this lost onion from the pantry and let it bolt into snowflake flowers. Would metal gutters attached to the fence work to grow spring mix? How about baskets hanging by the door and a fig tree in that patch of sun? Driving to the university where I teach, I pull over to examine a pumpkin vine trained up the side of a garage. Having coffee with a friend on the terrace, I take a picture over her shoulder of an intriguing combination of dill and goldenrod. Last year, I became obsessed with a zinc planter at the local food market, regaled with a little lime hydrangea and sweet potato vine. It would have looked stunning next to my gate, but it cost $400. Instead, I bought a metal garbage can and drilled holes in the bottom for drainage to recreate the effect. On summer mornings, shaded by an umbrella, the patio table doubles as my writing desk. My new husband calls good luck to me from the kitchen doorway before shutting out the mosquitoes. My daughters wave goodbye from the windows of their air-conditioned bedrooms. Barefoot, I open my laptop. Lavender and mint flavor the air. A grapevine tufts and swirls over the fence, dripping with chartreuse clusters of fruit. Cucumber vines waterfall from a planter. The wildflowers flit with butterflies and hum with bees. When I get stuck on a sentence, I refill the bird feeder for the doves or forage in a cedar bed for strawberries and peas. I watch a caterpillar nurse on the stem of a cornflower. If, as Virginia Woolf said, every woman writer needs a room of her own, I found mine outside. Those mornings at the table, alone in the company of flowers, plants, birds, and insects, remove the sting of my gardening failures. So many of my enthusiastic ideas do not pan out. The burlap sack planter yielded two potatoes. The garbage can, crowned with a hydrangea, still looked like a garbage can. I have a tendency to overplant. The hanging baskets by the back door became deranged with creeping Jenny. I lack a good sense of proportion. The fig tree was not meant to be 50 times as big as the Texas blue star. Sometimes I am indelicate, uprooting a watermelon plant in an attempt to untangle its vines. Certain plants continuously elude me. The zinnias, meant to be bright and zingy, always end up looking leggy and tacky. Every year, I clear-cut the mess and fill every last vase in the house. And then there is my tortured relationship with the koi and complicated passion vine. A periwinkle merry-go-round on a base of green, light green petals, the passion flower delights me more than any other flower, more than peonies, foxglove, chocolate cosmos, or climbing jasmine. I have planted passion vine every year since I first spotted it at a nursery, and every year it does not do what I hope, namely, spread its glossy foliage and burst with blooms from June through August. The first summer, the plant died in a pot. The second summer, moved to the ground, it grew only leaves. Last summer, with more fertilizer and another relocation, the vine crept up the fence, spurting tiny buds, then bigger buds. Each morning, I'd go outside with my cup of coffee to see what had bloomed. Each morning, the passion flowers hadn't. June went by, July. As summer tripped towards fall, I took out the map and wrote, "Never opened. Truly, is there anything more frustrating to a gardener than a passion vine cloaking your fence covered with flowers that stay shut all summer? A word of intricate, singular, magnificent, closed off to you." Despite such vexations, I've come to terms with the fact that I will never achieve my perfect garden. The actual bed will never match my vision of the bed. I'll never be an expert. I have only so much control. I can prune the fig tree all I like, but it might grow horizontally rather than vertically. White flies will come to the Brussels sprouts. The cardinals will eat the zucchini blossoms. A week of tropical rain will explode the tomatoes. The butterfly weed will take a year off from sprouting. And the passion vine will decide for itself when it wants to open, as mine finally did in the last week of August. I stood in the morning light, face to face with those five complex swaggering blooms, and I felt I was part of a miracle. And although the flowers closed back up by noon and never opened again, the memory of their beauty gives me hope for next season. And now we come to chapter 2, which is happy plants. Here's how to choose the vegetation that is right for you and the simple steps that will keep your plants thriving. And our first little article is planting a plant baby. Handling these common problems will help your greenery survive and thrive. And this is by Jenny Comita. And we may not finish it, but we'll complete it in the next podcast or program. Ferns in a sunny spot in the den, a little snake plant on the bedside table, basil on the windowsill. Plants have a special ability to turn a house into a home. Being a plant parent, however, is not without its worries. Chief among them, how do we keep these leafy life forms from ending up in the compost heap? My journal with plants involved a lot of trial and error, admits Hilton Carter, an Instagram star whose home is filled with hundreds of specimens. But if you educate yourself a bit, you can avoid having to say, "Oh, I messed up that one up. Let me go buy a new one." With a little knowledge, anyone can keep plants alive. And here's, do you need filtered water? Monocots like palms, dracaenias, philodendrons, and orchids are sensitive to fluoride and chlorine, common additives in tap water, and their leaves can brown from buildup. But you don't have to invest in a Brita. Leave bottles uncapped for a day. Many of the chemicals will dissipate, Weinstein says. And the three most common problems. The best way to figure out whether your plants are thriving is take a look at their foliage. Leaves can tell us a lot, says Paris Lelikata, plant education and community engagement associate at the SIL, an e-commerce plant site. Yellowing leaves. A likely culprit is overwatering, but it could also be cold temperatures. If the soil isn't wet, consider where the plant is placed, says Moby Weinstein, foreman of gardeners at the New York Botanical Garden and author of The Complete Book of Ferns. Is it near a drafty window? The fix. Move your plant to a warmer spot or seal gaps that let in cold air. Look for transparent weather sealing tape. Browning leaves. This could be caused by underwatering, over-fertilizing, sun scorch, or inadequate humidity. The fix. Invest in a humidifier to add moisture to the air. Dropping leaves. Don't worry too much about some shedding, especially with a recent arrival. Plants will often drop leaves when they're moved to a new environment, says Carter, author of several plant books, including Wild Creations. If you're suddenly losing a lot of leaves on an established plant, the cause could be cold, too much water, or lack of sun. The fix. Shift your plant so it's closer to sunlight or ease up on hydration. In general, succulent soil should be dry to the point of sandy, and fern soil should also be moist. Most other plants fall somewhere in between, checking the care and instructions. Is hiring a plant sitter over the top? That depends on your collection. If you just have succulents and cacti, you can likely go on vacation for a couple of weeks, Carter says. If you have ferns, you probably need someone in your house every day. If your plants need fall somewhere in between, consider self-watering planters. We've run out of time for today. Episode of Out in the Garden. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Anna Dean Silver, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Out in the Garden is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening.